This is an ABC podcast.
Are our houses and apartment blocks getting too big, and as a result, are our backyards disappearing? And could it mean that more of us will live in what some experts are calling, Jono, an urban heat island?
Yeah, Rish, a happy Monday. Now, demand for housing has led to more subdivisions and a loss of yard space and trees. And get this, block sizes for new houses across Australian cities in the past 15 years have dropped by 22%. So we're building on smaller blocks. So the average block size now is 467 square metres. And that all comes from the ABS, the Australian Bureau of Statistics.
Well, in Melbourne alone, about 240,000 new housing lots, and that includes homes and units, has been created since 2015. And now this is all as a result of subdivision. But this is what I find fascinating. While the size of the land is shrinking, the house sizes have remained the same. So this basically means that we are building bigger houses with smaller yards.
And that means we're losing residential trees and vegetation. And that trend is creating what's known as you mentioned, Rish, an urban heat island effect, when hard surfaces like concrete and steel absorb the heat and then they release it, which means that cities are sometimes between 4 and 10 degrees hotter than surrounding rural areas.
Gosh, that's a big jump. But this is such a tricky balancing act. We know that housing affordability and housing accessibility is a huge issue in Victoria. So can we have it both ways? You know, how do you balance having enough places for people to live whilst at the same time keeping our communities cool and green?
And we want to know if where you live has changed. How different does your suburb or town look today compared to 20 or 30 years ago?
Do we actually need backyards, or do we need to change how we're building? Where you live, has it changed? Does it look different to, say, 20 or 30 years ago? Are there more houses, bigger houses, more apartments? And is that necessarily a bad thing? We need places for people to live, but it is making where we live get hotter.
And I've certainly noticed, even in my lifetime, Melbourne has spread out and is encroaching on Gippsland. And when you drive from Gippsland to Melbourne, you will see just acres and acres of pretty much cookie-cutter homes on the suburbs of Melbourne. And, you know, they're not always on big blocks. The houses don't have eaves, but they are big houses. That's exactly what we're talking about today. But I'll be really interested to know if this battle between higher density living that we're being told is the way forward, instead of spreading out and urban sprawl, if that actually means that we're heating up those areas.
Texie, I feel sorry for the poor COVID dogs that have no yard to play in, says Sam. And people talking about how we build homes as well. So black roofs and black bricks should be banned. They absorb a lot of heat and then release it, creating a problem for the entire community, says John in Camberwell. And Geraldine's in Hampton. She says, huge single house just built next door, no room for any trees.
Now, Associate Professor Joe Hurley and his colleagues at RMIT have mapped vegetation loss in a number of Australian cities. We're going to find out what his work has revealed. Good morning.
Good morning, Rich and Jono.
Now, what exactly is the work that you've been doing around urban heat islands and how we're just building more buildings, meaning that cities are heating up?
Well, we've been looking at the concentration of heat in our cities, and also in particular its relationship to urban vegetation and canopy trees, and really trying to elevate our engagement with urban vegetation as a critical infrastructure of cities because of the role it plays in helping to cool our cities in periods of heat.
Is there a particular areas and particular parts of Victoria that you focus on the most?
Look, we've been doing comprehensive mapping of the whole metropolitan area of Melbourne, as well as other cities, Sydney and Perth, because, you know, this infrastructure is important in all our cities. But as you alluded to in the introduction, some of our areas have a reasonable abundance of trees, and these help cool the areas, cool those areas, whereas others really struggle in terms of canopy cover and are really susceptible to high urban heat island effect.
Yeah, and so you've done a lot of work, Clayton has been an area of concern. So why is that? Why is the area of Clayton in Melbourne a bit of an area of concern?
Well, that's just an example of, I guess, our newer developing areas, or developed in the latter part of the 20th century, where we've, in that period, as again you alluded to in the introduction, where we're building bigger homes, less space for gardens and less space for vegetation. So it's an example of a suburb where you've got low canopy cover, but lots of people living there, obviously, and therefore much more susceptible to build-up of urban heat and less protection during those hot periods of summer. But this, you know, that's just one suburb of many that we could pull from all of the cities around Australia. Many areas of our city are very susceptible to high heat and heat stress that causes on people.
And I wonder too whether this is pushing out into those bigger regional city centres as well, that this is no longer a city-centric issue. While we have you, Associate Professor Joe Hurley, let's go to some calls. Susanna's called from Mont Albert. Hi, Susanna.
Hi, Rochelle. Hi, Jono. Yes, I am calling because we see exactly this happen. So I live opposite a block that had a beautiful old weatherboard house on it, set well back from the street, surrounded by trees. It was purchased and demolished, and now it has got two huge townhouses on it, and the block is now 99% house with no backyard, really no front yard. So I feel that very strongly, but also what we're seeing, which is really, I think, compounding it for us, is that throughout Surry Hills and Mont Albert, but in other suburbs throughout Melbourne too, is we're losing huge numbers of street trees, residential street trees, because of state government transport projects. So our rail line is going into a trench, and to do that, we're losing huge, so we're losing over 600 trees.
And you're getting that from both residential areas and then, I guess, local works as well. When we look, Joe Hurley, at townhouses, it's very commonplace now for a home to be knocked down and for townhouses or apartments to go in. That's even factored into the sale price. You know, Jono, you and I were talking about this, you know, an old house or a beautiful old house, but it's on a big block. What you're buying is not that land and the house. You're buying the potential of what you could put there, Joe. So how problematic is this in particular for some areas?
Yeah, it's problematic. It's a real challenge. You know, as you said, again, in the intro, housing affordability, access to housing is really important in cities. Cities are complex places. So thinking about how we provide the infrastructure, the whole mix of infrastructure we need in our cities, including green infrastructure, but also housing in intelligent, well-designed ways, that's what we need here. And it can be done. But the example there from your caller of knocking down one house, replacing it with two, covering the entire lot effectively, that's not doing much for housing supply, but it is removing all the vegetation and probably not providing any space for significant contribution to urban canopy cover. We can do things differently. We can intensify, we can get housing yield while still providing space for canopy trees, but it has to be designed in, has to be planned in, and often we need policy to support that.
I'm really interested to know about how we support an increase in population. We know we've got an increasing population, and we've been told that the answer to urban sprawl is we have to build up, not out, and so we need higher density housing. But does that actually mean that suburbs and cities will heat up?
No, not necessarily. You need an active plan and actions to make sure that you're mitigating that heat through the materials you use and also through the use of vegetation. And this is starting to happen around Australia and around the world with, you know, those proactive governments that are looking at the right mix, the right design, the right policy to support urban intensification in terms of housing while still providing good cooling infrastructure through canopy trees.
Cecile's in Montmorency. Hi, Cecile. What did you want to say?
Oh, hi, Jono. Hi, Rish. I just wanted to echo Susanna's call, but also where I live is very near Greenwedge. And so it's a very, very leafy suburb with big gum trees everywhere, which do fall down occasionally. But what's been happening over the 10 years we've lived here is that we have noticed that trend of, you know, just raising the whole block and putting on townhouses. The issue I see is that if on top of it the government and councils don't preserve the trees on public land, we will then end up not living in a leafy suburb, because if private developers actually just raise everything in sight, and then on top of it, we're seeing that in Montmorency with the duplication of the rail line, which has lost loads of trees. And, you know, you think, well, developers and real estate agents are still advertising us as, you know, live amongst the gum trees, but there's no more. And we're kind of going, well, how do we stop it? Coming from Europe, I do feel that we need to work on building up where we can still provide green spaces around those higher buildings near the good infrastructure, rather than just building the infrastructure or, you know, trying to ram in new infrastructure or better infrastructure in places where we just can't afford to lose all that green space.
Yeah, look, thank you so much for your call, Cecile. Let's put that to Associate Professor Joe Hurley from RMIT. And there's a text here along these lines, Joe. Cassandra from Sunbury says, it's not all about the size. The design plays a part in the functionality as well. Architects are trying to design houses that are different from the others, but so many houses could be smaller if better use was made of the available space. So how do we not make the mistakes that we have in the past when we're designing cities and designing houses and places to live?
I'm loving your audience. These are great points
that
are
being
made by everyone so far. So, you know, there are we have planning regulations and design guidelines for all, that tackle all sorts of issues in terms of the way we build and change our cities. And we do have elements of those that talk to permeable space and urban vegetation, but they need improvement and they need to be properly implemented and enforced. And there's a fair bit of action going on in this space. It's pretty active space to try and tackle this challenge of getting the right mix between allowing for intensification, particularly to deal with housing affordability, but also ensure that private land has the space to provide and then goes on to provide canopy trees. So we can look at, you know, jurisdictions. Canberra, the ACT government have just released a whole range of new amendments to their policy that are really trying to tackle now comprehensively the contribution of the private realm to the, what we might think of as the urban forest, along with the public realm, because there's a limit to how much we can get out of that public space. And typically around Australia, governments are really quite on to now managing their public land for trees. But we can't just rely on the public space when typically about half of urban vegetation occurs on private land.
It's a text here in our Long Street in Mornington, where the only one few single dwellings remaining. So many properties here look like garages with houses attached. No canopies of trees. That's from Helen in Mornington. Kate's in Blackburn. Hi, Kate.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I bought a very old unit in Blackburn. I've had to rip out 40 square metres of concrete on the north and the west side of the house so that I can put back in a garden and put back in a tree. And I don't understand why it's permissible to concrete so much of yards and gardens. I know it's for parking, but there has to be something more sensible be done.
I wonder too, Kate, whether it was for ease. There was a real period, and I'm thinking back to my childhood in the 80s. Oh, concrete, it was everywhere. My mum, get this right, we were lucky enough to have a pool growing up. It was a very big deal. Around it, it was concreted and she painted it green to look it looks like grass, you know?
Yeah, you don't have to maintain it. And we were talking the other day about the millennium drought and how a lot of people would put in synthetic grass because you don't have to maintain it.
I wonder whether we're out of that trend. I mean, let's put that as our final question to Associate Professor Joe Hurley. The trend of concreting things for the sake of ease, you know, low maintenance, is that going away or is that still well and truly in our communities, Joe?
Oh, look, I think it's probably still there. I wish more people were like Kate. It's not so much the concreting, but the outdoor room, the kind of al fresco dining, you know, second kitchen phenomenon, which that's fine, but it does tend to occur with the loss of vegetation and not much space for vegetation to come back. You know, this is a critical collective infrastructure, and what Kate's doing by ripping out her concrete and replacing it with a permeable surface and with vegetation is contributing to our collective infrastructure to help make our cities more livable, to manage stormwater, to manage heat, to provide amenities. So I really think we need to think about it in those terms, that collectively we're doing a real service to ourselves and our own land and to the community when we can bring back and nurture vegetation in the city.
And I've seen some even waterways that were once turned into drains, basically, so they were concreted over in Melbourne and now been turned back into waterways. They're ripping out the concrete to...
Oh, thank goodness.
Yeah, yeah. But just before we do let you go, Joe, I wanted to ask you about green wedges, because one peculiarly, you know, Melbourne thing is these 12 green wedges that are, you know, you can't develop on. They're non-urban areas of metropolitan Melbourne that lie outside what's called the urban growth boundary. So you can't build on them. Do they help in any way in helping to keep the city cool?
Absolutely they do. That's a great legacy of the 1970s planning. You know, they were called the lungs of our city, and we need to protect those because as large areas, large concentration of trees are more effective in providing broader cooling to the city. But still we have these large pockets of large areas of our city which are away from green wedges, highly built up areas and not enough vegetation to cool them in periods of high heat.
We appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Great to be with you.
It's Associate Professor Joe Hurley, and he and his RMIT colleagues have mapped out vegetation losses across cities. And in particular, they looked at areas like Clayton, 1300 222 774. George is in Doncaster, but you wanted to speak about Clayton, George.
Yeah, I'm an owner's corporations manager, and I have a number of properties around Clayton. You're deluded. The way this system works is quite simple. A developer comes along and buys a block of land and he wants to pay as little as he possibly can for it. He then gets a builder and a designer, and the designer designs the house, and it may be an architect that does it. And halfway through the process, he takes it off the architect and gives it to a draftsman because that saves him money. They put up a house that is the largest possible house they can. They pour as much concrete around it as they can because then there's no maintenance for the owners to look after. The objective here by the developer is to sell the property at the highest possible price.
But how do we change that, George? I think we know that that's the case. Where does changes for planning or for limitations or for ensuring green space come into it, or does it not?
No, it's not in the equation at all. It's, you know, they're required to leave 25% of the entire block as open space. That accounts for the driveway. These people are trying to build as cheaply as they can. Mm. It reflects into the cladding issues we've had through Melbourne. It reflects into the cheap wire that we had to rip out of houses. You know, dodgy builders, dodgy developers do not.
But I think too, there's become. I think you raised some really interesting points, and I think too that the idea of being able to make money quickly on housing has become a really big issue. You know, it's and we've had chats about this in the past where it's become less of a place to keep you secure and safe and to live in, and more about something that you can flip and make money on really quickly.
Exactly, more of an investment. We look at, you know, housing now as an investment. You know, a lot of the time rather than somewhere to live. Let's go to Heath Gledhill now. He's the past president of the Victorian Institute of Landscape Architects. Good morning. Now, you've probably been having this debate for a long time, have you?
Look, it's certainly an interesting one and an ongoing one. I think just your previous caller there around, you know, whack up a development, do what you can to, you know, give a perception of outdoor space and sell it on is... unfortunately, a legacy that, you know, and listening to the conversation there, you know, I think people like Kate there that was talking around, how do you dig things up? How do we get things back and greening them, you know, is exactly the conversations that we've been having. But definitely a challenge as well, you know, among all of the callers that you've had on there that I was just listening to.
What I find interesting is that this is happening kind of across the state. There's a text here saying even in small country towns, they're cramming homes, you know, bigger homes, smaller blocks, not much garden. We've seen this happening and many of us are fighting to stop it. So this is not just a city problem. You know, it was once what we considered to be the concrete jungle. That concrete jungle is expanding out into regional Victoria.
Certainly is. I mean, look, I grew up down along the coast, down along the Great Ocean Road. Again, you know, really a great place to grow up. But recently I was visiting some family in Warrnambool, for instance, where urban sprawl in a setting like Warrnambool, where land is endless, but the density of the lot sizes that they're putting in are almost exactly the same as what we're doing on our outer fringes here in Melbourne. You know, we're looking at block sizes from 300 square metres, which to some of the conversation we've been having, people want to build a big home, so there's not much space that's left over.
And I see that around parts of Gippsland as well, and it's not just new developments. It's people wanting to do battle axe block subdivisions on the land that they have so that they can kind of subdivide off and make a bit of money as well. But what's the solution here? You've presented one potential solution, which is a rule that we should plant, you know, so many amount of trees per block.
Yeah, look, I think, you know, recently in the work that I've been doing and with a colleague of mine from South Australia around challenging the way that we go about things, challenging the norm, I think Joe was talking about, you know, good design and getting policy in place. So how do we think about that right across the board from our streets but into our lots, you know, and thinking about how do you have minimum distance between a tree, you know, so no human should have to walk further than our provocation was around 10 metres between a tree, you know, and if we can do that in a streetscape and prioritise vegetation over our services, if you like, so over power, water and what have you, which often take precedence, how do we do that and then employ that onto our residential lots as well, and what difference can that make?
Hi, Christy, what did you want to say?
Hi. I grew up in northeast Victoria, and a lot of farmland has been sold off in the last 15 to 20 years. And I think one of the major universities in Melbourne, I won't name which one, is doing a study on one of the rural communities up there that talks about it being a bed sleeper community. So they're tiny, tiny blocks. Everybody's jammed together. It's on prime farming land outside the edge of town. And then everybody doesn't participate in that local town, they commute to the regional city to work, play, socialise, play sport, and don't actually participate in the local small community, and there's no infrastructure in that local small community.
Infrastructure is a really big part of it too, especially where we're building new areas from scratch. You know, it's that old thing of what comes first, the home and then the infrastructure, or the infrastructure and then the homes. I mean, we haven't even touched on how public transport affects that. Were you shocked when you went back home and you had a look at how different it looks now, Christy?
Absolutely, because it used to be rolling hills with grazing cattle, and now it's tiny, tiny, tiny lots on top of each other with no backyard. And then everybody doesn't participate in the local sporting environment or the community. There's still only one general store. Nothing's open after 7 o'clock. It's quite sad.
So what rules do we need, Christy, to change things?
I think it's about when you have urban development, particularly in rural communities, ensuring that you create still enough green space but have the infrastructure. So transport in rural regional areas is critical, and also healthcare. Well, is critical.
Yeah, I mean, that's a part of, I guess, when we've seen so many of us move as well, the impacts on healthcare, on hospitals, on schools, on all forms of systems. Christy, thank you. Heath Gledhill is with you as well. This is a really tricky balancing act, as we said right at the beginning of the program, because we need more housing. You know, people are saying here it's all about population. You know, we need to cap population, but we need all forms of housing. We need accessible housing. We need affordable housing. We need social housing. And yet there's a big resistance, I think, now happening more and more so that we don't want medium and high density apartments in a lot of areas. So how do we, we're kind of damned if we do, damned if we don't. People need places to live, but we don't want the green space to go. I feel like we just need to stand still and not do anything. And that doesn't help anyone, Heath.
Yeah, look, and I think it's an interesting, as you say, it's a really interesting debate, and it's a really interesting problem. We, you know, with a lot of the infrastructure that we're doing around upgrading, you know, rail systems and bus networks across our city at the moment, Now, that provides that immediate access so that it, potentially people don't need a vehicle, which is a great thing. You know, that's a big environmental piece. But with that becomes these, what we know now, you know, in our documents such as Plan Melbourne, you know, 20-minute neighbourhoods or 20-minute cities. So how do we allow for that kind of densification to happen? But think about the way that we're building and developing. So there's some great examples. In Sydney, for instance, is a urban renewal project around One Central Park, which is a fairly significant set of towers that are there. But the greening qualities that have gone into that, so, you know, that kind of vertical greening side of things was factored into that built form so that it's actually become a, you know, a signature or a benchmark development. So how do we think about that on different scales, and how do we think about that in perhaps some of the, you know, the 2-3-story developments that are in some of our neighbourhoods to diversify what we're doing but equally contribute to the overall cooling and the benefit of our communities?
Yeah, well, it's an ongoing debate. We could talk about this forever, Heath, but thank you so much for your perspective. We appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you.
Heath Gledhill, past president of the Victorian Institute of Landscape Architects. And I'll be really interested to have a chat about Geelong, Rish, as well, because we're going to be chatting with the committee for Geelong as well as part of this conversation hour about the rules that are in place there and how they're trying to avoid some of the mistakes that have been made in Melbourne.
Yeah, what can you learn from what we've already done? And then a few texts along the lines of, well, has anyone actually asked people that are living in these homes and houses if they don't mind having much garden? A lot of people actually don't want it. They want the lock-up and leave convenience of an apartment and with more living space. And I guess that's absolutely right. But then the questions that we're asking is, does that come at an expense? You know, are areas heating up and do we need to find a way to make that balance? And when you look around the town or the suburbs that you live in at the moment, how much has it changed compared to 20 or 30 years ago? Do we actually need backyards, or do we need to change how we're building?
This is The Conversation Hour with Rochelle Hunt and Jonathan Kendall.
And Rish, it has been really interesting hearing from people about how their area has changed over the years, particularly the last 20 to 30 years. There's been lots of changes to suburbs of Melbourne, but also across regional Victoria, and this real push to have larger buildings on the same size block so that we've got what's called an urban heat island effect, where when we do have a hot day, it's hot in the city, Rish. There's a couple of texts here about green wedges, because I mentioned the policy of having these 12 green wedges around Melbourne that you can't develop on, that are just green space. Well, this text says part of the green wedge near Springdale now has the freeway through it. And this one says, don't forget the new train line will go through the green wedge area of Kingston Council. So even though you can't build on it, there's still, you know, there's public transport infrastructure there.
A lot of people have actually been mentioning the changes to train lines and whether, you know, they're going above or underground and the impact that that's having on trees. Before we speak to Dr. Kate Shaw, who's an urban geographer, let's have a chat to Denise, who's in McLeod. Hi, Denise.
Oh, hi, Rish and Jono. I just wanted to tell you a bit about the area. I live in McLeod. I've lived here several decades, and it's a beautiful treed area. I don't know if you know it. Lots of giant river red gums on big properties, small weatherboards, but that's all gradually changing. What's interesting is that new developments like to exploit the character of the area and say, come and live in this beautiful treed area, but when it comes to the crunch, they like to clear their block and then use our trees, if you like, to, how can I say, value add to their properties. So they'll build enormous developments, and our council does a lot to try and ensure proper planting of trees, but often it's not realistic. Mm. They allow tiny spaces for big trees, but they do like the character of the area, but they don't put back what they take out.
And I wonder how much of this comes down to individual councils. As you mentioned earlier, Jono, we're going to speak to Geelong, but Dr. Kate Shaw is with you, an urban geographer at the University of Melbourne. Kate, I think we've lost track here of towns and suburbs and regions and areas that this is impacting. It sort of feels like it's across the board.
I think it is. But look, it's been going on for a long time, hasn't it? I mean, I remember, must have been 10 years ago, there were findings that Australia has the biggest median house size in the world. And the planning minister at the time talked about housing obesity, which is not very nice. But in terms of the energy that they consume as well. I mean, certainly we're talking about issues of permeability or lack thereof. So not only do we not have gardens, but we don't have absorption. So we have a lot more runoff, which overloads the stormwater infrastructure. But they're also, these big houses are also a massive energy guzzlers.
Yeah. How do we balance it, Dr. Kate? Because on the one hand, we're trying to stop urban sprawl, so we need higher density living. Yeah. But on the other hand, we really need green spaces as well. So how do we make that happen?
Good design and good planning. The fellow who rang from the owners of corporation I think the point that he was trying to make was a very good one, and that is developers run the show. We don't plan for these, and we don't control the developers. The developers control the planning rigs. So that's why we end up with this continuing sprawl. Even though they're smaller lot sizes, they're still bigger houses. They're going out well beyond the reach of public transport, and so therefore we have to have 1-4-car garages. What we need to do is plan and regulate very differently. So, I mean, I think the interesting thing here is this question of what do we want? Okay, so this caller came in earlier saying maybe people want these, big energy-guzzling 4-car garage houses. I would say we want what we know. And I think demand, particularly in the case of housing, is driven very much by supply. So we have this model of this, great, wonderful house with 5 bathrooms and industrial kitchen and energy... And
butler's pantries.
And home entertainment room and so on. We don't have any model projects that show how fabulously we can live in a high-rise apartment, which doesn't have to be a dog box. It can be green, it can have balconies, it can have a rooftop garden. As one of your callers pointed out, it can be make better use of the area that we have. I mean, there was a project that I was involved in with some students many years ago that showed that good design in a very small space can be much more efficient and much more lovely to live in than a much larger space that's poorly designed.
Yeah, and this is an interesting text. He says, didn't Victoria used to be called the Garden State? But then there was another text that said, what about on our nature strips? Now, that's interesting because depending on where you live, you might take nature strips for granted. Now, trust me, not all suburbs have nature strips. And when you live in an area without a nature strip and then you go to an area with a nature strip, it looks and feels incredibly different. So my question then becomes about what's been labelled thermal inequity, that not all suburbs are losing trees either at the same rate or are not heating at the same rate. Are we going to see something like thermal inequity, Kate?
Sure, and it will correlate very closely to economic inequity and social inequity, and obviously the leafy places with the nature strips are the most expensive places. And I think one of the real tragedies of the trend that we're seeing at the moment, which as I've said is developer driven, is that the houses on the fringe are not getting more affordable. The prices are still set at a very, very high level. So if we want to increase inequity, be it heat equity, be it social and economic equity, we actually need to say that and plan for that and require developers and builders to provide that.
Let's have a chat to Felicity in the Yarra Valley. Do you agree, Felicity?
Yeah, definitely. What Kate said really resonates. I'm a landscape designer with a background in landscape architecture. And a few years ago, I worked as a junior assessment officer for the Federal Environment Department within the conservation and land use planning area.
So you're well qualified in this area. Do you think we need stronger rules to ensure that there are green spaces around housing developments?
Definitely. And I think just as we're seeing with climate change action, governments do have to be braver and take their role seriously in actually directing how developments occur. Because at that junior level, I try to suggest that we define green space requirements for new developments. And I was basically sort of laughed at and told that we can't meddle in that development space. And it was a very can-do capitalism mode.
And this is what is coming through, isn't it? And this is what you were saying, Dr. Kate Shaw. It's the developers are running the show.
Absolutely. Look, they always have. So it's always a battle. But time's up, really, in terms of indeed climate change and in terms of housing affordability and social equity. We really do need to regulate and also develop model projects. I mean, so just coming back to this point of, you know, we want what we know. We don't have enough model projects to demonstrate even radically different ways of living that we may decide are insanely attractive, and we want to explore more of them. We need to model. Governments need to regulate, and they need to model, and they need to support far-thinking developers, architects, and builders to model the kinds of developments that we really need to have.
Because there is an element of keeping up with the Joneses here, isn't there? Well, and you're talking about examples. Mark from Werribee can kind of provide a bit of an example. He says, hello, we have lived in a tiny 12 squares on a large garden. We have just installed solar and the house runs on 100% solar even during the rain. We work from home and we don't need a massive home, and I love my garden, says Mark.
See, that's what I find fascinating, is that sometimes if you flip this conversation, I feel like there's been a shift towards smaller homes, smaller footprints, understanding that we have an impact, being as sustainable as possible. But then we have a chat like this, Kate, and I sort of go, it doesn't feel like it's moving anywhere near fast enough.
Look. I mean, there are bits and pieces, and there are certainly models of hope. And yes, there's a tiny homes, you know, tiny houses movement, which is certainly gaining traction. But again, they're the kind of outliers, and in order to make them mainstream, we need government regulation and we need government modelling. And successive governments in Victoria and in Australia have been very, very reluctant to do that. Mm. And we need to make them do it, really.
I'll be really interested to see if any of these large-scale builders, you know, the large volume builders that you see building these huge homes in suburbs, particularly outer suburbs, if any of them come up with an eco model to kind of appeal to the environmentally conscious buyers, or you know, a smaller home instead of, as you say, having a cinema room and four space garage, etc., yeah, etc.
Get them on, Donna. Get them on and ask them, because they don't want to, because of course small homes mean smaller profit.
Put them on
the spot.
It's all about money. Look, thank you, Dr. Kate Shaw, Honorary Research Fellow in Urban Geography and Planning at the University of Melbourne. Is that what it comes down to, Rish? Is it just it's all about money?
I think so, absolutely. I mean, I do think there is an appetite for bigger was better, you know, housing obesity. I think that was a really apparent term that Kate Shaw used, and there was a period where, honestly, houses were so big. I remember driving around and looking at some and thinking, how many people actually live in that house? I'm sure there's not multiple families.
And do we need a cinema room, a butler's pantry, four car spaces, and
every room has an ensuite?
Yes, study nook, three bathrooms. Like, do we need all of that? I don't know. Maybe it's just there is an element of keeping up with the Joneses, but also just wanting what you've had and what is in the suburb. This text from Anne says, great chat. I live in the country now and I feel councils have a lot to answer for, since development is pushed by them, despite objections by community and a loss of native vegetation. Now, that's a pretty popular pastime in Australia, council bashing, but Anne reckons councils have a lot to answer for in all of this as well.
Kathy's in Northcote. Hi, Kathy. What did you want to say?
Good morning, and thank you. Whenever I drive out to the airport from Melbourne, on the left-hand side, you count all of the houses along there that have got a tennis court. You can tell by the lights that they've got. The houses are cheek to jowl. I'm telling you, cheek to jowl. There's not room. They don't have eaves. They have black roofs. They have not a room, a space for a tree between the houses, but they've all got a jolly tennis court.
I wonder how many people are playing tennis. I always think that as well. Like, how much have you got to love tennis, right, to put in a tennis court?
They better produce some tennis champions out at Tullamarine, I reckon. They better be
producing a tree.
Yeah, well, there's that too. But our next Wimbledon champion needs to come from Tullamarine, I think. But thank you so much for your call, Kathy. 1-300-222-774 if you would like to have a chat. Jen Cromartie is the CEO of the Committee for Geelong, an independent group which, you know, as it says on the can, is all about the advancement of Geelong. Good morning, Jen.
Morning. How are you?
Yeah, good. You're trying to avoid some of the mistakes Melbourne has made. Is that right?
Yeah, so Geelong, look, if your listeners aren't aware, we're growing faster than Melbourne, and that's only been exacerbated by the pandemic, with people coming in their droves down to the region, including, you know, the Bellarine and the Surf Coast. So we've also got what's called a Central Geelong Framework Plan that's under consultation by the State Minister, which is looking just at the Geelong CBD and things like height limits. So firstly, yes, I mean, we always try and look at mistakes that have been made in the past, but also maintain what we call our incredible natural environment, and why people want to come to Geelong is because of that. So we need to keep it.
So if you head through the city of Melbourne on a really hot, stinking hot day, it can be quite cool in there. And that's not because there's a lot of trees. That's because it's dark. It's full of shadows. The buildings overshadow most of the CBD. What are you trying to do within the city of Geelong to, I guess, keep it cooler, but at the same time not create the shadows that Melbourne has had? But at the same time, people want to live in Geelong. So you need to house people as well. Jen, this is a tricky spot you're in.
It is. I'll try and sum it up in terms of what we're trying to do in terms of a balance. So Geelong is on like what we call a natural amphitheatre, which has, you know, a hill that looks down over the bay. So part of what the state government's trying to do is make sure heights don't block that vista, which also means you don't have really high towers, particularly along the waterfront. So firstly, they're trying to get the density in the city, which they believe they can do. You know, we're projecting 12,000 people to come live in the city. At the moment, we've only got 2,000 people. So we're trying to look at how we put that residential experience and opportunity in the city whilst keeping the heights to a point where those views are maintained. But at the same time, we've got what's called a green spine. So we're only at stage one and two of this development, but it's greening Mallet Street, which is basically our major retail thoroughfare, to join our train station and Johnston Park through to the Botanic Gardens, which will basically be a fully greened boulevard through the city.
From what I can tell, Jen, it sounds like you want to make inner city Geelong young and hip. You want youngsters to move in. When I say youngsters, gee, I sound old when I say youngsters,
you
don't
do,
I?
But really do.
You want younger people to move into the CBD and you want higher density living, but you don't want all those things that Rish was talking about, the huge shadows from high-rise buildings in Geelong CBD, but you do want higher density living, don't you?
Yeah, so it's trying to get the right balance. So there's probably a few things I'd say is that we also are really keen to get international students back to the city, like I'm sure Melbourne is, because Deakin's a major part of our economy, and you know, we've got, you know, student housing that we'd really like students to be able to access. But at the same time, part of the Central Geelong Framework Plan is to open up green spaces that are currently car parks. So there's a bit of controversy around that, of course, because people want cars, you know, and places to actually park their car in the city. But we need a lot more people on public transport in Geelong. So it's finding the balance between your density, keeping and even increasing the number of green spaces in the city, but also having really good public transport networks. And really, to be honest, that's a big challenge for us. So if we can get, we only have at the moment 9% of people coming to the city on public transport. We need it to be 50%
in
the next
20
years. It is. So that would then increase, obviously, the opportunity for residents to come in the city sustainably.
It's looking at compromise. It's looking at balance as well. But Dr. Kate Shaw earlier spoke about you can actually have medium or even high density living if it's done well. I think we all feel a little bit burnt because high density living here, again, if it's being run by developers, are so ridiculous a lot of the time that if you're sitting on your couch, you can probably put your one arm in the toilet and the other arm on your stove. You know, like they're just so small, and that's something that needs to change. And green living can come into some form of medium or high density. Let's have a chat while we've got you, Jen, to Anne, who's in Ascot Vale. Hi, Anne.
Yeah, hello. I'm feeling that with the green lid bin that they should come for free, and so should branch pickups come for free, because I feel we're disadvantaged, the people that have a garden, and it's so tempting just to concrete everything, especially now my husband's died. It's just so tempting to concrete it all because it's just a lot of work and energy, and then you're penalised by you have to pay for your green lid bin and then pay for your branch pickups as well.
Yeah. Look, fair enough. Look, thank you, and sorry for your loss as well. It's but there, Rich, there are quite a few people like that who are really after convenience, who really need easy to maintain outdoor areas, and so that's the decision that they're taking is just to go to concrete.
And Jen, how do you then? Because we've had lots of architects text in today and say, well, the thing is, you need to engage an architect, but engaging an architect is expensive, and not everybody can do that. So it comes down to good design. Do you need to look at making good design more affordable and more accessible for more people? And is that something that you're looking at in Geelong when it comes to building up in the CBD?
Couple of things there. One, I'd like just to comment on your caller, and obviously super sad in her circumstance to maintain a garden. But with COVID, a lot of people have gone, we really loved the idea of having a garden when we were in lockdown. So yeah. We've actually seen the reverse trend, obviously, with people wanting to come here to have access to green spaces. But I'm not sure, again, if your listeners are aware, but Geelong is a UNESCO Creative City of Design. So we've actually put a lot of work into what we'd call environmentally sustainable design practices. And when we say access to, obviously, architects and great design thinking, what we're hoping is as a city to be able to incorporate that in every single design, that's particularly in the CBD and throughout the region. So hopefully what it means is we'll be able to provide that support, dare I say it, maybe through council, because we've got a fantastic proponent there, Dr. Jonathan Daly, who is an urban design specialist and our champion of design. So hopefully if you're doing a development in Geelong, you'd be able to get that advice and actually, yeah, we can live the principle of being a creative city of design on an international scale.
And just before we let you go, Jen, I want to ask you about building heights, because we've got a text here saying Geelong height limits are too high. I'm not happy about development in Pakington Street and not happy about sprawl joining Geelong to all coastal towns. Now, there's some new rules that the state government has put in place, and that limits heights in Geelong CBD, in CBD's 8 precincts, to between 13 and 60 metres to protect the character of Geelong and ensure minimal overshadowing from buildings. So where do you stand on the height of buildings in the CBD?
Yeah, well, this Central Geelong Framework Plan is what they're referring to, and there's interim height controls in Geelong. So we've put in quite a few submissions and appeared to the committee on that advice. And we're generally in support of what the state government's trying to achieve. But the issue is you've got things like the listener who's texted in around Pakington Street. There's multiple what we call UDFs going on in and around the city, which are putting more pressure, to be honest, on
Hang
the
on,
city.
Hang on, what's a UDF?
Sorry, Urban Design Framework. So
Urban
basically, the council's got different frameworks in South Geelong and Geelong West, essentially, to get more development that is dense around the transport lines, our train station, which we fully support. You need to get core housing, full housing, train lines, so there's equitable access in our community. We don't have anywhere near enough social housing in affordable housing in Geelong. So I know what your listener's saying is a big controversy on heights at the moment, but we support what the government's trying.
There's a little bit of pushback, though, here, Jen. Just finally, I have to say there's a lot of people that don't seem super happy about this. I'm saying, look, you're spinning a rosy picture, but it's not necessarily what locals want. Lots of people saying that they've moved from Geelong. They're saying they're not interested. They don't want higher or bigger. This is all about the developers. How do locals feel about this? Or is it just a case of, well, the people are coming anyhow, we need to find a way to build and build well?
Yeah, and it looks so people understand we're not talking about having, 20 stories, 30 stories in Geelong. I mean, 60 metres is not a really big building. So any pushback from community that we've seen has been about heights that probably have already happened. What's actually happening now is that they're actually reducing heights in certain areas in Geelong where it was actually unlimited prior. So prior to the height controls, there were no limits on some of those areas. It's now being managed and controlled. But it's those areas around Geelong West where I think people are concerned about the heritage areas of Geelong West. That is not where those heights are coming. It's more towards the rail line. So we'd be supportive of getting more density closer to the rail line as an example. And I'm not sure if you said people were moving away from Geelong, but they aren't. They're actually coming to Geelong. And the demand is outstripping supply at the moment. We've got a major issue.
Well, it's a huge growth area, Geelong. I think conservative estimates forecast Geelong will have added another 85,000 people by 2036, but it could be as high as 152,000. So it's just such a growth area. Jen, thank you for having a chat with us.
Thank you, no problem.
Jen Cromartie is the CEO of the Committee for Geelong, and where the state government has put in some height level restrictions on buildings in the CBD to try and avoid some of the mistakes that have been made in Melbourne. Rish.
Rebecca's in Bendigo. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, guys. Can you hear me okay? I'm in the car.
Yeah, we can hear you fine. What do you want to say?
Yeah, look, I'm ringing to be an advocate for nature, really. I grew up in Melbourne. I'm now a sheep farmer near Bendigo. And I returned to Melbourne just recently, went for a walk with a friend, and the housing development on some of those beautiful suburban blocks. And just a couple of things, when I was in Melbourne growing up as a kid, my mum used to get the huntsmen's out of the house with a rag over her hand. I just challenge people to stop and think, how much of nature do they see in the inner suburbs of Melbourne now? And with this housing development, you know, it's just, I think we need schools to become involved in educating children about the need for nature.
I know, but Rebecca, can I suggest that the hook that you use is not a huntsman?
Like, you should have seen Rebecca. Rish just screwed up her face when you said huntsman. You know,
just find something else. Like, I totally get it, but huntsman, you're not winning.
Rochelle, can I just challenge you on that one? Because
yes.
Everything in nature is beautiful and it all deserves a place.
I know, I agree, and I'm trying really hard to be that person that doesn't freak out, especially with huntsmans, but I can't, because my pa would do that. He'd pick it up in his hand, even talking about it now makes me want to vomit a little bit. But
can I just tell you, my niece actually voluntarily put one on her face one day because they are harmless.
Rebecca, how did we get onto this conversation?
From urban planning to huntsman
on your face. But Rebecca makes a really good point, that we haven't even touched on today, is that once you remove all of those trees, once you remove all of that green space, then there goes the habitat as well.
Yeah.
Not just the huntsmans, but the butterflies, you know, the worms, the birds obviously goes without saying. There's so many impacts.
I've even noticed that, and you notice kind of pest species moving in. So even just use of garden chemicals like Roundup, that'll often mean that you won't have other little critters. There's little, you know, frogs and stuff getting around your garden. So it's all a balance, a tricky balance, Rich.
I was listening to a story about frogs today. I'm thinking, I reckon there's a show in frogs.
Oh, yeah.
Very good. I'll just put that on the side.
The backyard frog count has been on. So maybe, I don't know whether that's what you saw.
No,
but,
it was all about this frog. It's a long story, but it's about a frog that swallows its eggs and then regurgitates them as a way of giving birth.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Not sure how we got onto huntsmans and frogs that regurgitate, but it's been fascinating today. If you missed any bit of this or you want to go back and have a listen, then the best thing to do is to subscribe to the Conversation Hour podcast. That way you won't miss an episode and you can share it.